ahead and get started in the interest of time. I assume there's more people that are scrambling in. Several of you have been here at earlier sessions this week, and I don't want to do a recap of what we've done, other than to say the focus this week has pretty much been about problems. And I've certainly focused on that, you know, what's wrong with various aspects of our society. The other instructors have done likewise. I know two of Sangeetha's sessions have been about the mega events that musicians put on to try and address various aspects of poverty and disease and that kind of thing. John Nunez spoke all week about what Lutheran World Relief is trying to do to help alleviate some of the problems. I want to shift focus tonight to something a bit more positive and see if we can kind of envision what it would be like if peace were a top priority for our various social institutions, religion, business, government, education, whatever. I want, before we start talking about that, though, to talk a little bit about what peace means. And I've asked Patty, my wife, to help me with that, since she has a degree in it. The first point that I would make is that peace is more than absence of conflict. I think most of us, when we think about peace, think of it in terms of not fighting or not being gunned down in the street. Tell me again, Patty has a master's degree in conflict transformation and
peace building.
Okay. I should know that.
Conflict transformation.
And peace building. And it's those last two words, peace building, that I think are critical here. Those two words imply that there is a process to go through and things that you have to build before you can have peace. And so I've asked Patty to speak a little bit about what peace building is and how it works. So I'll turn it over to you.
The best way I can give an example of it was to tell you about the Hollow Water experience. Hollow Water is an Indian reservation in Canada, and like a lot of Canadian reservations, as well, First Nation communities, as well as Native American communities in the U.S., we took the children out of those communities and relocated them and re-educated them very, very far away from where the parents were, so that the kids would learn our language. European American is what I'm referring to as my ancestors. And then the children, when they became adults, were hopefully, the plan was that they would want to stay in that area. One of the educational camps was in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. That's a very famous one. But those children went a long period of time without seeing their parents, and the people who filled in those spots were priests and nuns, in most cases, in the educational communities.
Tell me when this was.
Late 1800s and early 1900s?
Okay. Yeah, more late 1800s.
Yeah.
So when you said we, you didn't mean you.
No, that's what I was saying about my European American ancestors. Mine came from abroad. That was the plan when we took the children away. We as a government took the children out of their communities and relocated them to these educational camps. They stayed there until they were 18, And then the expectation was that they'd stay in the area and get jobs and assimilate was the word that was used most often. But a lot of those kids wanted to go back home. There are pictures of them before they were given their uniforms and their new haircuts. And then there's pictures afterwards with the more traditional haircuts that our ancestors had. And then there's these pictures that historians have collected. They're very rare, but of the children who found their way back to South Dakota or to their home villages in Canada and then tried to reacclimate into those communities where their families had, where they'd come from. There were three generations of those kids that were taken away. And what happened in Hollow Water, and I met one of the women who came from Hollow Water at Eastern Mennonite University where I was studying, was Hollow Water knew that there was a tremendous amount of poverty and a lack of job opportunities. And their chief had learned that there was a thing called social work, and that if he could get a couple of the women to go to a university and study social work, they could come back and help the village. And the name of the community is Hollow Water. So the women went to the University of Minnesota. They got bachelor's degrees in social work, and then they went back to Hollow Water. When they went back, they started open communication with the children. What the two women had learned was there was something called incest. And that something was actually the norm at Hollow Water. And it was the norm at most Indian reservations at this period of time. These women are a little bit older than me. I'm 54. That was really hard for me to process when I first heard it, because I was working full-time while I was going to graduate school for HUD. And I was working, doing peace negotiations after homicides had taken place. So I was trying to imagine how you would not know about incest. But if you've been raised by people that aren't your parents, and you've been exposed to something and told that it's normal, what I've come to understand is you come to believe that is normal. And what was happening was that some of the leaders in those educational institutions were having sex with the children. And so the children were seeing them as fathers and as mothers because they didn't have any examples of fathers and mothers. They'd been removed from their homes. So this thing must be normal, but it also doesn't feel very good, but it still must be normal. Then they go back to wherever the communities are and they repeat that behavior with their children, thinking it's normal. Well, at this point, time's progressing and some of the children are being more exposed to outside communities of children. And so they're beginning to pick up on the fact that maybe this isn't supposed to feel good. I don't think it's supposed to feel good. And so a dialogue begins with the children. But nobody can go back and tell mom and dad that because mom and dad think this is normal and they believe mom and dad. Well, the two women who got their social work degrees began a dialogue with the children where the children felt open to tell their stories. And the children were saying that they didn't like this thing that was going on. And the Indians do what I've come to call peace circles. And they have these circles, and in the circles, everyone is equal. Regardless of your age or regardless of your position in the community, we're equal.
And those are conditions that people agree to before they participate in it, right?
Right. And so what the two women suggested as they began to collect the stories of the children was to have a community circle specifically giving the children the voice to tell their stories with the understanding that the community would be open and loving and there wasn't anybody that was bad in this process or wrong. And that is key. there wasn't anything that was going to happen to the children for sharing that story, and there wasn't anything bad that people were going to say to the adults who were learning that this thing that they're doing was in fact hurting people. So they had, there was a filmmaker that actually was permitted to film the circles. And we listened at Eastern Mennonite to this woman tell about this, and then we saw the children in the circle sharing their stories, and the moms and dads beginning to start talking about how it didn't feel good when it was happening with their mom and dad, but they thought that's the way it was supposed to be, and then just everything kind of unraveled. But what we were experiencing as we watched that was the fact that nobody was being kicked out, and that it was okay to share your feelings, and that the most important thing was to be accountable for your part in that process and to agree that you're going to work towards building a better community and a healthier environment for everybody. So that's the Hollow Water experience.
Thank you. What I want us to focus on in addition to that is that this peace-building process that Patty's describing can be used anywhere from an interpersonal conflict in a school situation to international relationships. Patty didn't tell you that the vast majority of students in her master's program came from overseas. She's had the experience of sitting in a class with a Hutu and a Tutsi talking to each other about the generations of conflict that they've had. Same with Israelis and Palestinians, Serbs and Croats. These are all kinds of things that happen. But I do want to just say another couple words and then open it up for discussion. The kinds of conflict that we should be thinking about, I think, is more than just armed conflict. It's more than just crimes of violence against other people. We can talk about economic violence. We can talk about religious violence. There are all kinds of things that humans do to each other that these peace conflicts or these peace building processes can be helpful in. I don't believe in miracles or coincidences, whatever, but I've got to tell you, I ran into one today. I love to read, and so I was thrilled to see what a great library is over here, and I've taken a couple books from it and read them, and I love murder mysteries. I've never read a book by this guy before. His name's Thomas Adcock. The name of the book is Thrown Away Child. And I won't go into all the plot, but as I was reading it this morning, I ran across, the guy uses a quote from Martin Luther King, which seemed to me to be a great introduction to this whole topic. And the quote relates to Dr. King talking with young African-American men in the beginning stages of the Vietnam War. And as you know, King was an advocate of nonviolent resistance that he had learned from Gandhi and all of that. But I won't read this quote, and it's not that long, but I will say this, and I think it will be a good introduction to what we want to talk about. Dr. King said, "As I have walked among the desperate, rejected, and angry young men, I have told them that Molotov cocktails and rifles would not solve their problems. They asked if our own nation wasn't using massive doses of violence to solve its problems, to bring about the changes it wanted. Their questions hit home, and I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly about the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government. Violence is refusing to give up privilege and pleasures that come from immense profits. Violence is when machines and computers, profits and property rights, are considered more important than people. Violence is a nation approaching spiritual death, a nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than on programs of social uplift. I will tell you one other quick story that Patty and I ran into last spring, just about a year ago. We were invited to attend the final week of U.S. Army War College in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Every year the Army brings in a batch of colonels and majors that they see potential for going on to general. And they put them through the equivalent of what they call the PhD program in the Army education system. And this final week of the program, they bring in a group of civilians with the express intent of getting the Army personnel to interact with civilians and have an exchange of ideas. And during our time there, we ran across something really, really weird. The Army has an office at Carlisle that is, I forget the exact acronym, but it is the Sustainable Peacebuilding Unit of the Army. Now, I can tell you after sitting for a week talking to these guys that they like to talk about killing people and breaking things. And that's the way they talk. And let me say here, I have the utmost respect for these guys. We've been talking about that experience for a long time. It was me. But the idea of having the Army also be involved in the peace business just seemed odd. And those people tell you it's odd. They don't know how to do that. You know, they've been trained to kill people and break things. They don't know how to go about building peace. So with that kind of mismatch of information, if you want to call it information, I guess I'd like to open with the question that I said earlier. What would religion look like? What would business look like? What would government look like if peace truly was a top priority?
Nobody knows.
Really, the unknown. And Darren, if I may, will you allow me to repeat some of our conversation? Darren is an ex-Marine, the only one we've ever met. We always thought you were a Marine for life. But Darren has been involved in armed combat, has experience that I certainly never had. So there may be some questions he can answer for us tonight. Any ideas? Well, let me narrow it down first. You want to talk about religion, government, or business to start with?
Business.
Okay. You want to talk about it?
Well, I don't know. I just feel like that's kind of your expertise. So I wanted to hear what you have to say.
Well, I'll start the conversation by saying that there's a real paradox there. The idea of multinational corporations was, in many people's mind, going to be the solution to world peace. Because if you're Coca-Cola and you want to sell Coke in China, it doesn't help much if the United States and the Chinese are in a war together, or in a war with each other. And so there was this thought that is, corporations spread across the world, that they would influence governments to stop fighting with each other so that they could profits. Well, the opposite side of that is there's a lot of corporations that don't make much profit unless there's war going on. So, you know, we can argue either side of that. Judging from world situations today, I would guess that the military-industrial complex is winning on that side. Can you envision how would companies make a profit if it was peaceful?
They would have to change their accounting system because we're so involved in what quarterly balance sheets that we don't look at the big picture. If we looked at the big picture, we might have a different approach to that, for starters.
Okay. We might be able to talk about the fact that there would be more customers for their products if they wouldn't keep killing them.
We had more resources to make products if we were using those resources in a sustainable way, blah, blah, blah.
Okay. Good. Yes.
Well, I mean, there are several investment companies like Pox World Fund or Calvert that invest in companies that don't produce weapons or tobacco or the variety is multi, but if we, as, and you mentioned retirement accounts a couple nights ago, and that kind of hit home a little bit. If we, as stockholders, said, we're not going to invest just in anybody, not in Washington mutual funds, that just doesn't have any parameters in that way, but we're going to invest in Pox World Fund, and the more of us that do that, I mean, a critical mass would make a difference.
Yeah, you're talking about what is called socially responsible investing, and the amount of money invested in those kinds of funds has grown significantly over the past 10 or 15 years. It's still a drop in the bucket compared to the overall investment market, but that is one way that we could go about doing it.
I'm sorry that I didn't hear you last night. Could you, in about two sentences, summarize what you were saying, what you said about competition? My reason...
Last night was a hard sell.
My reason for asking it is, it seems to me that competition is such a strong motivator, and war is kind of an ultimate competition, and fear is the base of that kind of stuff, and therefore, how the heck would you get people to work?
Yeah. I think in, you know, 2 minutes or less, the conversation last night was that competition is more inherent in some cultures than in others. And certainly in the United States, competition is a central factor in what we are and how we approach life. I gave some examples of other cultures that are much, much less competitive. The other major component of that is the argument that because of competition, the goal becomes to win. And if the goal is to win, then people pretty soon become willing to do whatever it takes to win. And so the basic argument is the existence of competition as a structural element in society necessarily means that cheating will occur. And as we think about how we might want to reduce the cheating, we only touched on this at the very end, was the idea of cooperation being the opposite of competition. And to the extent that we could build structures of society based on cooperation instead of competition, we could reduce the amount of cheating. Or, as you're suggesting, we could probably reduce the amount of conflict.
You and I talk about this all the time, so you will help me explain this so it makes sense to others. But isn't it true that, like with Patagonia, the guy who started that you can make money and have a successful product and have happy employees that actually make a livable wage, but also do things that's for the environment?
Oh, yeah, it's possible. If any of you are interested in reading something, a really, really cool book was written by the founder of Patagonia, can't tell you his name. It's French. He's French Canadian. But the name of the book is Let My People Go Surfing. yeah. But it is an incredibly cogent argument for building a sustainable business in which your employees are driven by an intrinsic motivation to make the world a better place. I mean, the whole point behind Patagonia was to build mountaineering equipment. The guy who founded it, climbing the mountains, still does. But the equipment that he used was inferior, and he was climbing mountains that life depends on whether that, how do you say it, piton?
Piton.
P-I-T-O-N?
Piton.
Piton.
Piton. Piton.
If your piton breaks or comes out of the rock, you're dead. So he wanted to make sure he had good equipment. But as he built his business, he wanted to make sure that he did it in a sustainable way. And so back to your point, yes, it's possible. I would say that it's highly unlikely, except as in Patagonia's case, it's wholly owned by one person. And so that one person's values drive how the corporation is shaped. And here I come back to that idea about retirement accounts. You know, if you're a company owned by mutual funds, insurance companies, and hundreds of thousands of individual investors, those people, by and large, are concerned about financial return on their investment. And if you're harming the environment, so long as you don't get sued, all the better.
This is quite a different direction than I wasn't here today.
Please, go ahead. I can shift gears.
But when you're talking about doing this, building peace, she was part of the American University Women. Mm-hmm. And they were concerned about middle school girls making it in the educational system. And so they developed these sister-to-sister summits where these middle school girls would strategize what are the issues that are harming are doing well in our schooling, and then to come up with a strategy together. And the mothers kept saying, where is there something like this for our sons? And so they developed a brother-to-sister conference to try and get the girls and the boys, middle school kids, to talk about this. And I was part of trying to get something with the boys, and I said, I know what needs to be done, but I haven't got the wherewithal to do it. I said, these boys are spending most of their time on video games, which have to do with shooting and competition and that sort of thing. What we need to do is, they would not go well with trying to build this peace through conversation. But can we build video games that would have the goal that they could do the hands-on thing and work towards cooperation, that sort of thing. But that was as close as I came to it. But that would be my image of, I think our socialization, girls would have their own issues, but our socialization of males.
You should have been here last night.
It's a big issue in this whole bit of violence.
Just one quick side note. It's interesting that you mentioned American University. It's the only university in...
No, this is the university.
American University of Women.
American Association.
Oh,
it got its start with trying to get women to succeed in education at a college level. That was their goal.
Okay.
And then, thank you, with you.
Throughout my almost entire academic career, almost every course that I took, I was an individual, and I was competing against everyone else in the room for an A grade, and that was the model. That was just how we did it. But in one class, it was a statistics course, the professor said, now I'm going to divide you into six groups, and there will be eight people in each group, and you will get a group grade. If the whole if all eight of you average out a B, then that'll be everybody's grade. If all eight of you average out a C, then everybody will get a C. And maybe you'll all get an A if everybody reaches that level of competence. And we all just threw up our hands and said, no, we can't do that, that's not fair. But some people are really smart here and some people maybe aren't going to do it. He said, that's how it's going to be. And in future job opportunities, you will often be working as a team. And your team will rise or fall depending on how all of you as a team do it. So, go. Well, we set up study groups like you wouldn't believe to make sure that everybody did as well as they possibly could. And boy, we made everybody attend those. And they had to show that they understood the stuff. And none of us were going to take that test until everybody could do it. And in the end, I thought, that is a good model.
How did your group do?
How did you do?
How did all the groups do?
We got an A.
And how did the other
That's all that mattered.
I don't remember. Yeah. But not everybody did. But I do know that overall, we did a whole lot better than we would have done had each person individually tried to compete with the next person and get a better grade.
So that's a statistic class which is leading toward a business degree?
Or well, there's kinds of degrees. There's lots of things in statistics.
So can that strategy be applied in business?
Sure.
Cooperation,
and
support.
Well, I wanted to ask, I'll get back to the business question. What was your field?
Nursing.
Okay.
Well, in this particular class, it was a graduate course in statistics at the University of Minnesota, and we were all getting a Master of Public Health.
Okay. The reason I asked that question, do we have any, I know you're in education, can you all enlighten us on the concept of cooperative learning? Does that ring a bell? Can you tell us about that?
Who else was the educator over here?
Okay. I can speak to that one too.
Okay.
Well, yeah, if you guys would tell us the kind of the idea behind cooperative learning, what the theory is.
I'll just start and I'm gonna leave lots of holes and you guys fill in the blanks.
Hey, that's cooperative learning.
I mean, I have a poster. I teach middle school, 6th, 7th, and 8th in screen for over 3 years. I did 6th graders, 7th grade, and 8th grade all the way through. But on my wall, I have a poster right up front and center that says, cooperate with others, compete only against yourself. And it's a way for them, and I have them in groups regularly. They're the days when desks were in rows facing forward, at least at our school, are over. Mm-hmm. A lot of teachers have even gotten rid of desks completely and have kids work at tables. And you've got 5, 6, 7 kids working at a table. I think 5 is the optimum group. 4 to 5 is an optimum group. But the method that you tried, try that among a bunch of middle school students, and you'll have a riot on your hands also. Mm-hmm. The idea, however, is to try to get people of varying abilities to work together, intentionally putting people who are ELL, English as a second language, English language learners, and people who are special ed students, and those people together with people who are brainiacs. So you put people of differing abilities together with the idea that you give them a group grade and don't give individual grades. Like, have them work on a project, and whatever they produce is the grade that you give for the group. Now, there will be kids who do nothing, and they get an A sometimes, and that's just the way it is. Sometimes they will drag the group down, and they might get a C or a D, and that's the way it is.
Do the parents object?
I have not had a parent object to that. I have not had people object to it. I'll just stop there. You guys can...
What's the theory behind cooperative learning? Why is that?
One of the things they stressed to us when they taught us, they being when I was in my teaching program, learning to be a teacher, to the extent that you learn that when you're in college, they differentiated between cooperative learning and just group learning. Group learning meaning you put them in a group and you tell them to do this project together, and then the brainiacs take over and they either give grunt work to the kids they feel aren't quite as bright, or they just all themselves. In cooperative learning, ideally, each person would have a very different role in the group, and none of those would be make work kind of role, busy work roles, but they would all be valuable roles, but they'd be different, and every role would be necessary. And it can be argued, whoever was just talking about how you work in teams in the real world, oftentimes engineers don't even get to work alone, which is difficult for some of them who went into engineering because they wanted to work alone. They have to work with other people who have a completely different skill set, completely different specialization, and they have to figure out how to make the whole thing work together. Setting that up can be a nightmare because we aren't used to thinking that way. But it's a great idea.
And it's my understanding that in true cooperative learning, the idea is that the brighter kids cement their learning by helping the kids who aren't as quick learn what's going on. The kids who aren't as quick learn better because they're hearing it from the teacher, they're hearing it from their peers. And so, done well, my understanding is that cooperative learning means that everybody learns more than the individual competitive model. And I think that's one example of how we can talk about cooperation might be better than competition. Yeah, Darren.
That's an idea that's been a part of the American military or military organizations as a whole since the Roman legions. I understand it's new within the educational system.
That speaks volumes right there.
Well, and not only is it new, but it's also
foreign.
Foreign,
radical,
very
controversial,
radical.
Yeah. I'm shocked. I'm really, because I'm like, when I was in the Marines, you know, it was 20 years ago. You either work together or you die.
Yeah, right.
I mean, there was very cut and dry. It was very black and white, and there was no question. You know, we had a set chain of command, you know, call it draconian if you want, but it worked. And now it's being trying to be copied in the educational system. But yeah, I mean, just in the military, it's just for me, it's like, what do you mean people don't understand teamwork?
Yeah.
You know, and to use the same thing, the cooperative learning is kind of a funny thing. I use it on my school bus, because I drive school bus now. I get an educator, but I had a group of kids. I'm still a substitute driver, so I get thrown into a different route all the time, every day. And I had one group where I knew some of the kids. Well, the kids in the back were pushing the limits. And I spoke to them several times. It's a rural route, so I just, middle of the road, stops, hit the brakes, hit the lights, and got up and went to the back of the bus and said, okay, from here back, if anybody messes up, everybody gets a pink slip. They said, you can't do that. I said, there's the right way, there's the wrong way. Didn't have a lick of problem out of the rest of the afternoon because all the other kids were like, dude, shut up. Or whatever it was, but it was cooperative.
Now, let me ask the flip side to that because I'm really interested in this.
Okay.
When we were at the Army War College, and I was a guest, so I was just trying to process. A lot of these guys are Fulbright colonels, which I learned means they're almost a general.
Yeah.
And so they have pretty weighty jobs. And after they're done there, they're leaving for Iraq and Afghanistan. And I'm thinking to myself, there's hundreds of them. I'm thinking to myself, some of these men aren't going to be there, or women, aren't going to come back. And as we're talking at this evening gathering, a couple of them are asking me what I do, and I was not wanting to get into it very much. But they said, well, you know, we're trying to figure out how to do what you do, peacebuilding. And I said, give me an example of how you're doing that, because I'm thinking in my head, you've got this bulletproof vest on, and you've got these things I see on CNN, and you've got your weapons, and when I go into housing projects and there's been a murder, I don't carry weapons, and I don't go with cops, and I just go like me, otherwise I would be dead. And so I don't know how soldiers can do peace building, but what they said was, we're going into Afghanistan right now, and we're saying, okay, right now we have established peace. We have this zone where nobody's killing anybody. Now what are we going to do to build a village and make it so that we can now go home to our families? What needs to happen so that you all quit killing each other and you can get along? You need a school, we'll do a school. And he sat there and named it. You need a hospital, we'll build a hospital. What's going to make you all want to live together in peace so we can go home to our families? And I thought, that's not how it's going to work.
Yeah.
You can't do what you said, I don't think, to adults and expect them to all button up and get with the program.
No, it's very specific. In the United States, the military role, I mean, having been there and done that, I mean, and it's just my humble, uneducated opinion. That's not what the military is for. The military goes in and provides security, and then as I understand it, the only way that it's ever really worked is if the locals, feeling safe, like they're not going to get killed walking from their house to whatever business or school or whatever, it's up to the local population, wherever it is. I mean, it doesn't matter where it is. It's across the board. It doesn't matter what the culture, what the geography, anything. The only thing the military can do is help you feel safe, and then it's up to the locals to do it.
And
for the American military, yes, they do.
Francis Fukuyama, one of my favorite academic authors, wrote a book several years ago, and I can't remember the name of it, but the basic idea was how our current foreign policies aren't going to work very well, because the idea of coming in from the outside and building democracy
doesn't work
unless, well, it doesn't work. The only way democracy happens is if the native population demands it and builds it from within.
The classic example of that is it doesn't even work internally for us. I mean, we can cite examples. I mean, talking about examples through the 60s. I mean, you sent the National Guard into Kent State University, and look what happened. And that's Americans on American soil with American students trying to bring two ideas together. I mean, it doesn't work. The force of arms is a very last resort.
Excuse me, sir. I'm sorry, I should know your name.
I'm Chris.
Chris, you had a hand up earlier, didn't you?
Well, I did, but because, I mean, you said that people in the military have to cooperate, otherwise they'll die.
Yes.
There's a serious motivator for working together.
Profound motivator.
And, you bet. And in education system, some kids are motivated and some are not. And there lies the rub for cooperative learning.
Yes. Desire to cooperate.
They just don't, many kids, especially, I work with 60% free reduced lunch kids. Some just, they don't, they're kind of encrusted. They're grown up and they live in a system of poverty, and they don't see any way or any reason to get out, and certainly don't see education as the way to get out. Their parents live in a certain way, and that's the way it is. Or they may have all the video games that they need, or the food that they gotten used to. If it isn't enough, at least they've gotten used to that amount and think, that's just the way it is, and education sure isn't the way to get out of it.
No.
If there needs to be a way out of it, which gets to my modest proposal that I think kids actually should go to work before they go to school. I think you should skip like sixth grade and work until you're in 12th grade and then start school after that. But that's just me.
Well, I'm not quite that radical, but
it's
I was thinking we ought to take a couple years between high school and college.
I mean, it works for the Germans. I mean, everybody admires German engineering and, you know, this idea of, you know, everybody knows what a BMW is or whatever. And that's, German engineers cannot work in their field or even get their degree until they've worked for 5 years as an apprentice or as a layperson in their specific discipline before they can even have their degree and say, okay, now I can go out and design stuff. So, I mean, it's...
Germany doesn't let people be idle unless they're very, very determined to be idle. And if they're very, very determined, chances are they won't be idle because they're determined.
Yeah.
We, on the other hand, in the name of freedom or something, really don't engage much with our teenagers at all, the very formative time of life that they're trying to figure out what they want to do. We want them to
their main influences on their life are each other, which is, you know, blind would almost be better. They at least wouldn't move as quickly and wouldn't drive cars. We really don't give our teenagers much of value to do with their lives, and that would speak to what Chris said about what makes cooperative learning really work versus just kind of people going through the motions. If they see the value in what they're doing, then they'll want to do it. And that really speaks to what you said about the military. I think the essential question for us, to use a educator buzzword, is can we finally see that our very survival as a species relies on us being able to cooperate? Yeah. Can we finally see that we have the proverbial gun to our heads in terms of the way we're treating the planet, trashing it, and that sort of thing? Because if we have that same kind of urgency that our people in the armed forces have, then we might actually learn how to do it.
And then the defense.
Hold on, just a second, if you were there.
Go ahead. I'll pick up.
Real quick. Okay. In the defense of teenagers present, it's I'm pleasantly surprised as a bus driver that there are the majority of our teenagers are motivated, that I have noticed. I get into conversations driving school bus that I don't get into conversations with adults because adults shy away from being wrong.
But I bet they love the fact that you're willing to talk to them too.
Yes,
they don't have enough of that.
And people ask me, they look at me like I'm crazy. I'm a school bus driver because I love it. And they ask, well, why do you like it so much? I said, because I get to talk to kids all day long.
That's awesome.
But I hate to sound negative, but you don't hang out where I hang out.
You're in Bellingham,
Washington.
I know. I'm in Utopia.
And I'm in South Central Los Angeles, and I'm in Chicago.
And I've been to those places also. I've been to those places also, and I empathize with your situation also because I have friends and I've grown up and was in the Marines with.
Okay, I'm reserving the last 5 minutes for myself.
Go ahead.
So, you have
like, I want to go back to what I said, and my head is just spinning here because I spent a week at Army War College also, and my wife and I were at this speech by Martin Luther King you're talking about, and so I spent 7 years overseas teaching in a former communist country, Slovakia, where kids had learned about group learning. That was the idea, that the whole class succeeds or fails or whatever. And there were some interesting things about that. One of them was that this did not stop cheating. It even encouraged it. And they would give us a bad time. As you say, you Americans, who are so into competitive stuff. We cooperate here. But they would cooperate by telling each other the answer to the questions and by working together on tests and by, you know, all this kind of...
Letting the smart people do all the work and then just give their answers to
which my response was, but someday one of you is going to be a brain surgeon and I'm going to need brain surgery and you're not going to dig into my skull and have these other kids around you saying, well, that's that, I think, or what is that? Or, you know, you're going to have to be doing it yourself, so there has to be some individual responsibility here. But I guess I want to go back to this word fear. It seems to me the Marine thing works because you've got an ultimate fear that's pretty motivating. Kids who are on the fringes of being able to manage things sometimes make it if they do one of these month-long hoods in the woods experience thing, where again, chicks in the sticks, it's a girl feature. But there again, if you are scared crapless, you can get a level of cooperation. Which may be
a poor social motivator.
What's that?
It's a poor social motivator.
So I still go back to the fear thing. I mean, fear, like it or not, is a strong motivator. What do we have to take its place or to get people motivated who aren't facing it?
I do want to address that too, yes.
Well, I kind of want to go back to something that you said, do communities really know how to create peace? And I think sometimes yes and sometimes no. I mean, obviously the Native American, the Palo Water, they had a system, the Peace Circle. And they had a system that you could kind of plug into and teach them how to use it to heal this terrible society wound that they had. But I guess whoever needs to discover is, does, for example, Afghanistan or whatever, do they have systems for solving stuff so that they, you know, so that you, someone like you could step in and do a little bit of advising and then off they go? Or, I mean, but I guess I'm like you, a little bit cynical, really? Do these communities all have a system in place to which, because of our security, they could then create peace? I don't know, you know, that's certainly an interesting question.
I don't know the answer to that either. There,
yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
No.
Yeah, you do. They have those people coming in.
Just speak to people.
I can't believe he's saying he doesn't know. They're actually hiring some of the faculty and some people like me. I'm not one of them over there, but they're hiring some faculty from Eastern Mennonite University to go over there with teams of historians and educators and peace builders to help the communities. And they're doing very similar to what the guy in Three Cups of Tea did, which is a very Mennonite kind of thing.
Are you all familiar with that?
Yeah.
And they're empowering the individuals in the communities to work together for a common goal. And in response to what you said, since you're talking about the youth that I work with, fear doesn't work. It absolutely does not work. And it's not for me. There's lots of people with PhDs who say that. Long term, it doesn't create a sustainable peace.
No.
What does work is buying people's support through compassion and through things like a common goal. And it lasts. That's what I was going to say.
One thing I would add, and thank you.
Let's have a quick comment. I completely agree with what you're saying. I was hearing that fear motivates. I just don't know if that's the right kind of modification, or maybe it's just short term. But I was thinking that with what Darren was saying about talking to adults, that building relationships and trust, and where people that are in insecure environments or unsafe environments, they can't trust others enough, and they can't trust people as a whole in order to cooperate with them. So I was thinking that some sort of fundamental trust is necessary in order to cooperate.
Right.
I was going to add in there, there's a new book out called Drive by a guy named Daniel Pink, who talks, he kind of summarizes various theories of motivation. And the basic conclusion of the book is that extrinsic forms of motivation, rewards and punishments that come from outside, are in the long run ineffective. That if we want good results, we've got to find some way to get people internally motivated to do what they do. And I think that goes along with what you two were saying, that there's got to be a level of trust, you've got to show compassion, you have to put people in an environment where they can succeed based on their internal motivations. The other thing I wanted to touch on, and I should know your name too.
I'm Robin.
Robin, thank you. You've been here every night this week, I think. You asked earlier about, does this cooperative learning stuff that we're talking about, education, group work, can it translate into business? And again, I have to go back to what you were saying about the difference between group and cooperative learning. I mean, managers in business are as susceptible to fads as anybody. And 20 years ago, somebody decided that forming groups in a business was the way to attack problems. And so now, that's the solution to every problem there is. Oh, we got a problem? Form a team. We'll do it. Probably 50% of those groups or teams, and there's supposedly a difference I won't go into,
But probably 50% or more of those teams fail at what they're doing. And a lot of that is because the members of that group haven't learned how to work together. Despite what we think in America that teamwork comes naturally, especially in our society. The other big reason that groups are not as successful as we would hope in a business setting is that we haven't learned how to reward on a group basis, just like grades. I mean, you know, our compensation systems are so ingrained to be individual. You know, if you do a good job, you get a raise. Well, if he's good, he's not real thrilled about being on a group and having his livelihood depend on group efforts. So part of what we have to do is in some ways, a very mechanical solution to that. We need to figure out how to design compensation systems that reward for group effort, but also recognize individual contributions to that group effort. And that's a very difficult thing for a business organization to do.
Didn't work under communism.
That's because humans ran communism, didn't they?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, an effort was made in that direction, and then so much motivation was lost, you couldn't get anybody to do anything.
And isn't that sort of the issue in general, is that with the economy of scale that we're dealing with now, what difference is one person's action really going to make? When one person works in a company that's part of a bigger company, that's part of a multinational corporation, and why should I work to change the culture here? I mean, I see that as part of the problem with motivation in young people too. It's like if they saw people doing something for a living, they could envision themselves doing something that they saw the older people around them. They could learn from the older people around them in a formal setting or an informal. And there was a intrinsic motivation. I want to do what the job that so and so is doing, not the job that so and so is doing. Now it feels like there's not a whole lot of control that people have anyway. There's these big entities that control everything, and yet we talk about world, you know, change in the world as the sum of just a bunch of individual actions. What can we as individuals do? I don't know if there's anything we as individuals can do, at least until we become bigger than just individuals.
Well, yeah, I think you're right. I don't think any single one of us sitting here is going to change the world. Speaking from an organizational standpoint, couple of things come to mind. One is, organizations have, in my opinion, gotten too large. There is a breakdown in community if you get over a certain number of people. And so the loyalty that individuals feel to organizations is basically gone because the loyalty from the organization to the individual is gone. But in spite of all that, what I would tell my students in management classes is, it's the manager's job to figure out how to build that culture within his or her own organization so that people feel valued and feel that they can contribute. I will also tell you, having worked in private industry for close to 20 years, there aren't many good managers out there. Mm-hmm. They just, on the one hand, and I'm sorry, I'm getting off on management here, but on the one hand, management should be the most natural thing in the world. Because what management is getting other people to do what you want them to do. And we've all been doing that since we were infants. I want food, I cry. And Mom better give me something to eat. And we, you know, to one level or another, that's how we interact with the world. And yet you put us in a business setting, and all of a sudden we think we've got power and we can tell people what to do and all of that, and it just doesn't work. So consequently, there aren't many good managers around, at least I don't think so. Oh, okay. Well, here's the last 5 minutes condensed into two. First of all, thank you all for observations over the week that I've been here. And one of those observations is that there's been common themes running through the classes. When we started the class, I talked about we've all been pointing out problems, and probably me more so than others. But there's been another theme that has been running through this, which is doing something about it. Again, Sandeetha had at least two sessions on mega events, how musicians produce these big things like Live Aid or Band Aid or something that are designed to help help the poor, help the sick, that kind of thing. The last such mega event that she talked about, do you remember what it was called?
Earth, something like the Earth.
Live Earth. Which occurred in 2007. Sangeetha pointed out that that was different than earlier mega events, in that the earlier mega events were designed to raise consciousness, get politicians to do something, whatever. Live Earth, on the other hand, which was a concert that focused on global climate change and all that kind of stuff, the purpose behind that was for people to make individual personal commitments to change the way they live, to do something themselves to make the world a better place. Peter Holmer this morning in his final Bible study, he was talking about the resurrection of Jesus and how people responded to that or didn't respond to it. But one of the things that he said that struck me was, you know, what is this new life that we are supposed to have because of Jesus being crucified and resurrected? And the consensus kind of was, well, that new life is that we let go of our old ego and we live with his influence. And Peter said two words that just struck me, and those were, get busy. Start doing stuff. And, you know, John talking about the Lutheran World Relief, he, in his handout today, the last thing we did was recite, I don't know what you'd call it, a poem or whatever, that St. Teresa of Avila said about Jesus no longer has a body on this earth. We're the body. We have to do it. And that is the message that I want to leave you with, and I will do this. I haven't even told you about this. We're not Lutherans. Patty and I aren't. No, that's, oh, I know.
What?
Patty and I go to a Unitarian Universalist church. Based on how long it takes to write that, we tend to refer to ourselves as UUs. I don't know where this came from, but a couple of nights ago, it occurred to me that what those two U's should stand for is unless and until we do something to change the world, it ain't gonna change. So I'd leave you with that. Thanks.